Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hello, I'm Troy Abels from Hanford, California, and you are listening to Gospel Tangents.
It's the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology, and first daily Mormon history podcast. I'm Rick Bennett. I'm excited to continue our conversation with punk rock polygamist Moroni Jessup. We're going to talk about what research he's done into the priesthood ban and talk about his third and fourth excommunication. So you won't want to miss this conversation. Check it out.
So they commissioned me to start gathering information, me and another one of the 70s. So we started researching. We started collecting evidence. And some of the things I found out that Joseph Smith had started the first mission to the Polynesians in what were then called the Cook Islands. Way back in the early days, that was one of the first missions that he called, actually, was to the Cook Islands. Brigham Young had sent missionaries to Tonga. They sent missionaries to New Zealand. They sent missionaries to Samoa. They sent missions to all of those. And not
India.
Only that, yeah. And not only that, but whenever the LDS church, you know, like this happened in the Cook Islands, the French government expelled the LDS missionaries. They left the care and the priesthood functions of those particular branches in the hands of Polynesian saints. So it doesn't make sense to me that they're restricted. And, you know, I even found a quote from John Taylor where he called them, he called the islanders the House of Israel. And of course, those who know fundamentalist history know that in 1886, John Taylor allegedly set apart men to perpetuate plural marriage, and that was the basis for fundamentalism. The same year, 1886, he declared in conference, in April of 1886, he declared the Polynesians to be the House of Israel. You know, it wasn't making sense to me. History, LDS history was not matching with what fundamentalists were teaching. And at that point, I started assembling all this information, all these quotes into a packet. Me and this other brother traveled with that family to New Zealand, which is still one of the best experiences I've ever had in my life.
Wow.
You know, because this woman was a Maori. My experience of New Zealand was going into the homes of Maori, into the homes of Samoans, into LDS chapels there that had all islanders. And I went to the Hamilton Temple, mm-hmm. you know, into their visitor center. And they had a notebook full of testimonies in there. And there was one man who talked about how the Maori had had prophecies that the priesthood would come among them. And so I asked the people in the temple if I could photocopy that. And so I did. I photocopied
nice.
It. And I put it in this packet. And so I went
now,
to...
Now, wait a minute. Did you introduce yourself as Mormon or non-Mormon? Or
they just assumed I was Mormon. I mean, with a name like Moroni, that's kind of easy. And, you know, so me having been a former LDS member, I can kind of speak their lingo anyway.
Exactly.
We went to like the Polynesian History Museum in Auckland.
Mm-hmm.
We gathered as much evidence as we could that, you know, there's no, and the, what we were trying to make a connection is that there was no, okay, you know, it was a start, but that there was no connection between sub-Saharan Africans and Polynesian people.
Right.
That's what we were trying to establish.
Oh.
That these people aren't cursed. These ones over here are, but these ones aren't. I mean.
So only the Africans are cursed, but Maori and Polynesians are not cursed.
Yes.
That's what you decided.
Yes. That's what we were trying to establish. So, I mean, I feel embarrassed talking about that part of it, but that is what we were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, I remember even we stayed at the home of this guy over in Taupo, New Zealand, who ran a farm for their Maori tribe raising red deer for meat. We stayed in his home, and brought out this really, he was a non-Mormon too, not Mormon at all, but he was an artist, and he brought out this picture that he had drawn that was really beautiful. One side of it had Polynesians, and the other side of it had Native Americans, and it was had similar art motifs. They both revere eagles and eagle feathers,
mm-hmm.
and he titled the picture "Our People Are One."
Oh wow!
And I took a photo of it. I thought that it was beautiful, but the guy that I was there with, my fellow 70, just point blank asked the guy, "Are you guys related at all to the Africans?"
Oh.
And the guy just kind of got this quizzical look on his face, like,
What are you talking about?
But little did he know the struggle that we were going through. So
right.
We got back from New Zealand. I prepared a packet, all the quotes, all the material, a thick stack. I put it in a manila envelope for each one of our council members, and I presented it to them in a formal meeting. And they totally glazed over it. It didn't matter that I had just traveled halfway around the world to try to get this answer. They had already made up their minds.
Facts be damned.
Yeah, facts be damned. So what happened then, these people had intermingled with us for 3 years. Of course, one of the daughters fell in love with one of our young men. And the young man was the son of one of our apostles, one of our council members. And this particular apostle got the idea, hey, you know, this is when the 23andMe type of DNA tests, ancestry tests were coming out.
Oh.
He said, hey, let's do a DNA test on one of these kids, you know. So one of these girls, she's, her mother is Maori, her dad is Tongan. We did a 23andMe DNA test, and it came back. There was like, I don't remember the exact percentages, but it was like a mixture between Asian, European, and Native American. 0% sub-Saharan African. And so based on this, this particular apostle said, well, I'm going to seal this woman to my son. And there were threats from the other side. They said, if you do this, you're going to be cut off. So,
infuriating, isn't it?
So I assisted them. We went.
You assisted the apostle in the sealing?
In the endowment ceremony where endowed this young lady. A lot of people were in absentia. They refused to participate in protest. They didn't show up. But we endowed this young lady, and we sealed her to this young man. And then afterwards, we had a wedding reception, and some of the people that disagreed showed up. Most of them didn't. Well, the next Sunday, as usual, I told you we had a prayer room. We decided to all meet for prayers. And when we got to the top floor, every one of us had a key to that upstairs room. Anytime we wanted to pray or use that room for prayers, personal prayers, we had access to it. that morning the locks had been changed. And that's how I was excommunicated the third time.
Wow.
The locks were just changed. Our keys didn't work. And everyone else was there. And the guy who was senior out of the three apostles got up at the top of the stairs and made a big announcement to everybody. He said, if you are in agreement with this marriage that has taken place, this is not your place here. Mm. You know? And so I persisted in attending with them for a long time, for about like 3 or 4 months, because I was the not only the head 70, but I was the youth Sunday school teacher. And so I persisted in teaching my class.
Even though you couldn't go to these prayer meetings?
Even though I couldn't go to the prayer meetings. And my wife had been primary president. And we would go to sacrament meetings. And the way they do it in fundamentalism, okay, it's all extemporaneous. They'll just call people from random to get up and bear their testimony.
Oh.
And that's the way fundamentalist meetings generally go.
Oh.
And they...
would they ever pick a non-member?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, actually, really?
They make it a habit of picking on visitors.
Oh. So,
but the one guess who they didn't pick after that point, nobody would even look in my direction, you know. So it was like I was like a non-entity sitting there. And the other families had already started meeting on their own, but... The thing is that I had already gone through a division in the AUB. I didn't want to see another division taking place. And so I persisted for about 3 months. And then one Sunday I had been gone. I went to Tucson for work. And when I came back from Tucson, I found out that Sunday that they had without thanks, without even telling me, they had called somebody else to the position of youth Sunday school teacher. And they had called somebody else to the position of primary president. That's how we found out that we were cut off. They just randomly called somebody else to our positions when we were gone.
Wow.
So that was it. That's excommunication number three. So what happened at that point was the community got split right down the middle.
Mm.
Half of the families were on one side and half of the families were on the other. And that division still exists. In fact, we used to call the people who were opposed to the Polynesians, we still to this day amongst ourselves, we call them the other siders, because they're on the other side. So they're the other siders. So we started meeting separately. And for a long time, I mean, it's like, I have to say that on the other siders, there was people like my mom. There were like siblings. So it was not a neat division, and there was feelings, you know, and we're talking like this is around 2007. So, for a long time, you know, those people said that anybody who had performed in that temple endowment, that they no longer held the priesthood. So they basically thought that I had lost the priesthood at that time, that I held no more priesthood.
Because you polluted the temple, right?
Exactly. Mm. You know, it's funny. I'd been through an excommunication in the LDS Church. I'd been through an excommunication in the AUB. This one hurt the most.
Yeah, I bet. Because it was all family, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, so you were cut off from your own family.
Cut off from my own family. Now, I do want to say that it's been many years since then, and the divisions have kind of softened up that we'll do social functions with the other siders now. We'll and
what's your side called?
Now I'm on nobody's side. Nobody's side but my own. But we're still, we keep getting ahead of ourselves. I'm getting to that.
I'm sorry.
But so I'm on speaking terms with my mom. They know that I've been out publicly talking against racism and mm-hmm. against the priesthood ban, and they have issues with it, but they never approach me face to face and say, you're wrong. I just hear rumors that, yeah, they've been talking about what you've been talking about on podcasts and stuff like that, you know, at Sunstone. But, so we did this DNA test. Okay. And, by that point, I mean, we're just a small handful of families. I've been kind of brought into the little priesthood council, which just amounted to just a few of us, you know. And so the apostle that had his son marry one of the Polynesians, we're talking like about 10 years later. He says, you know, maybe we ought to do DNA tests on ourselves.
Oh.
He says, if we required her to have a DNA test, it would only be fair if we did one on ourselves. And at the time I thought, I honestly thought, no, this is a really bad idea.
Okay, so my screw up in the Paul Reeve interview was I had attributed this to AUB, but it's really the Thompson Group or the other side.
That's right, the Thompson Group. You know, we knock at people's doors and we say, hey, hi, we're the representatives of the Thompson Group that used to be part of the AUB, that used to be part of the LDS Church. Would you like to hear more? But so anyway, he says we should do these DNA tests ourselves. And so he took one of the children from one of the other families in our group, paid for a 23andMe test. And then he took my daughter and did a 23andMe test on her and paid for it.
He was too chicken to do it on himself?
Well, I have to say that both children were his descendants also. So I don't really want to, you know, I'm kind of avoiding mentioning names here.
Yeah.
But he was related to both of them.
Okay.
Okay. And he sent the test off and then.
Well, couldn't he blame any results on the spouses?
He could, but so then what happened is that we went on vacation up here to Utah, and we went to a family reunion over in Duchesne. And then afterwards, on the trip home, we decided to stop by Rockland Ranch. Those of you who don't know, Rockland Ranch is a polygamous community over by Moab. They have blasted homes out of the side of a cliff wall and then built the homes inside of what's essentially caves. And it's really cool. It's really cool. So, the community there, they're very open and very friendly. They come from different backgrounds there as well. They have people from different groups that have decided to live there. But I have a really good friend that lives there. And on the way back, on our way back to Arizona, we decided to stop by Rockland Ranch and we stayed the night. And we visited and then they put us in this back bedroom, which is essentially way in the back of the cave. And once you close the door and turn the lights out, it was like being in a sensory deprivation tank.
Mm-hmm.
There was no sound. There was no light. It was just totally pitch black. And we went to sleep and slept just like really great. Well, I had a spiritual experience in the middle of the night.
Oh.
I woke up and I knew I was awake because I sat up and I touched my eyes to make sure my eyes were open, and they were. But there was a woman that appeared to me. And she had long, dark hair, and she was dressed all in white, and she had, like, this unearthly glow all the way around her. And I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was a spirit. I don't know if it was an angel. I call her an angel. I said that I saw an angel that night. But she kept showing me different scenes. And then when she would show me the scenes, she would dissolve away, and I would see the scene. And then afterwards, she would reappear and she would look at me. She never said anything, but she would look at me with purpose and intent, like, do you get what I'm saying? Do you get it? And the things that she showed me a skull. And then she would look and she would say, you know, look at me with purpose. And then she showed me a group of people that I saw a crowd of people as far back as my eyes could see. There was a group of people. And then she showed me a line of sand that was falling out of the sky. And when it hit the ground, the sand was tracing a spiral pattern on the ground. And then she would look and she would say, do you get it? And she showed me each of these things three times. And so, you know, while I'm having this experience, I'm not thinking, oh, this is weird or this is terrifying. It's just like a part of me just accepted it and observed it as it was happening. And then after she showed me these things, I rolled over and went to sleep. It was just as simple as that. And I woke up in the morning and I immediately wanted to call a friend of mine. I have a friend of mine who's really good with dream interpretation. She's not even Mormon. So I didn't have signal. So I had to wait until we got back on the highway. And I called her up and I said, okay, this is what happened to me. I had this experience last night. What do these things that I was shown, what do you think they mean? And then I said, okay, the skull, that's got to mean like death or something, right? And she says, no, not necessarily. She said a skull could represent knowledge. And I'm like, okay. I said, what about the crowd of people that I could see, you know, as far back? And she says, yeah. She's like, that's your ancestors. That's your ancestors. I said, what about the line of sand that's coming down and tracing a spiral on the ground? She goes, oh, that's easy. That's DNA. And I'm like, okay, you know. And so we drove back to Arizona. In fact, this that I'm talking about happened exactly 6 years ago this month. And so we got back to Arizona, and as I'm pulling into my driveway, the apostle that I was talking about is waiting in the driveway, and he's got the results to the DNA test in his hand.
And, they're not going to be good for him, I have a feeling.
And so, well, it wasn't good for me either, you know. But I looked at it, and, you know, there was, you know, it's my daughter. My wife is a half Asian. I'm half Mexican. There were things in there that were predictable, like the Asian DNA, the Native American DNA, you know. And there were some things that were kind of, you know, I always assumed I had a lot of Spanish, but I have very, very little Spanish in me. It was like point something percent, you know. And there was a little bit of Middle Eastern / Jewish ancestry, which I kind of knew.
Oh.
And then there was like sub-Saharan African, Nigerian, like
really
3% or something
like 3%. That. 3%.
And I just looked at that and I stared and I couldn't believe my eyes. And I looked at that and I said, this has to be wrong. This can't be right.
So this was a DNA test for your children.
My children.
Okay.
But see, he knew that it wasn't from his lineage because the other child came up with zero. So it was only from me.
Oh. Oh, so, I thought you were going to say he had some too. Okay.
Well, I don't know. I know he's done one on himself and I've never seen the results. But actually I don't care at this point.
Right.
But so I'm staring at the results and I'm thinking, this can't be right. You know, this can't be right. And he's talking and I'm stunned and I'm not even hearing what he's saying. But when I start paying attention, he was saying something like, and we got to let everybody know about this. And I'm thinking, what? You know, and I said, and I told him, I said, this can't be right. I know I hold the priesthood. And so,
so you've got one drop now. Yeah, you're ineligible according to Brigham Young.
Yep. I'm according to the proverbial one drop rule, I am in violation. So I went home that night and I tossed and I turned. And the way it felt to me, it felt like my whole life was a lie. That I had believed that I had a right to the priesthood, but in truth I really didn't because of this DNA test. And that's what I was feeling and that's what I was thinking. And then the next night, same thing, I tossed and turned and I was really disturbed and I kept waking up in the night just like in a start, like, oh, you know, unbelieving. It's hard to describe what I was feeling at that point. The next night, something different happened. I started remembering instances in my life where I remember the priesthood manifest in things that I had done in my life that I knew that I had used my priesthood, blessings that I had given, experiences I had had, healings that I had taken part in. And I thought, how could this be? How could this be right? How could I not hold the priesthood if these things have happened in my life that show me that I have held the priesthood? So then my wife and I started to study out the thing. And, you know, a lot of the things that Paul Reeve talked about, I came across for the first time in my studies. I had never had to question Brigham Young's teaching before, because I just accepted it at face value. And I think that's why fundamentalists have such a hard time overcoming this, because they cling to the old teachings. And if Brigham Young said it, it's got to be true because it's Brigham Young, you know. So I got to a point where I started systematically questioning the origins of the priesthood ban, where it came from, what started, and the fact that men like Elijah Abel and Key Walker Lewis held priesthood and were ordained. And I learned some things from your interview with Paul Reed that I had never heard before.
Like, good.
Yeah, like the fact that until 1908 that men weren't systematically given the priesthood, that you had to, that it wasn't normal for every 12-year-old to be ordained to the priesthood. So the fact that Elijah Abel had received the priesthood at all shows that they knew what they were doing when they gave it to him.
Right.
You know? So these are the things I'm wrestling with. And I finally came to the conclusion that the priesthood ban was not a thing. And my attitude was, I know that I hold priesthood whether or not the DNA tests are right. But I had other family members that were like,
are you questioning the DNA test?
Well, now, where I'm at now, I think that the DNA test is accurate, but it doesn't really matter.
Oh.
You know,
but at the time, you were really questioning it.
I was really questioning it. I think that I know I've talked to a lot of people about how they do the DNA test, and sometimes they put in things like Nigerian as just a filler where they don't know where the marker comes from.
Okay.
Know? So there's a possibility that I don't, but whatever the case, the fact
it's still African, though.
Yeah. Whatever the case, it gave me the impetus to start studying it and start questioning it. Like I mentioned, I had another family member that was like, well, I know the DNA test is wrong because I know I hold the priesthood, you know. Mine was like, I know that I hold the priesthood whether it's right or whether it's wrong, you know. I know I hold the priesthood. And so at this point, what started happening in our community is we all got together. Everybody who's an endowed adult member got together for a meeting. And
this doesn't include the other siders, though.
No, it's just our community.
Just the half siders.
Just the half siders, yeah. So we get together for this meeting, and we laid the whole thing out on the table. You know, this is what the DNA test said. You know, what do we do from here? And the consensus that we reached was that, you know, it's kind of like a, and I hate to even put it this way, innocent until proven guilty. You know, I hold the priesthood until it's proven I don't. You know, and so that's kind of the decision that we made, that until we knew for sure that I was still going to function in the priesthood, I was still going to not be restricted, and I could still go to prayer meetings, I could still function, I thought that it was a consensus, but obviously there was other people in the community that had a problem with that.
Uh-oh.
And it became evident when one day I didn't go to our Sunday school, but my wife did. My wife was a Sunday school teacher for the little children. And the Sunday school teacher for the youth, and I have to say most of the youth were my children. And my wife, it was in somebody's house, and she just happened to walk out of the room to go get something from the kitchen or something. She could hear the Sunday school teacher in there telling my children. We hadn't even told my children about what was going on yet. But the Sunday school teacher was saying, well, I don't know. If you live your life worthy in this life, maybe you'll be eligible to receive the priesthood in the next. And my wife exploded. She just blew up. And what are you teaching the kids? You know, so she pulled them out. She pulled the kids out. And we never returned. You know, and so that was excommunication number 3. Now, the guy called me up you know, the apostle, he called me.
Number three or number four?
Yeah, you're right, number four.
Okay.
he called us up and he said, I want you to keep coming. He said, I don't want you to stop coming. He said, I want you to keep attending. And my wife said, but you want us to not function in the priesthood. Just attend and be lesser members.
Second class, essentially.
And, you know, in essence, he was like, well, yeah, you know, but I don't want you to stop attending. So I think that in his heart, that his heart was in the right place. And I still believe his heart was in the right place. He just faced a conundrum. The conundrum that he faced was that he could not, right? He based his whole testimony on the Polynesians based on the DNA test. He couldn't accept her DNA test and reject ours. It created too much of a conundrum for him. And so, you know, and I do want to point out that at this time that I had put a lot of study into it. I still have put in a lot of study in it. If a fundamentalist wanted to debate the Black Doctrine with me, I could, but I felt unequivocally to let it happen. To let the division happen, let the chips fall wherever they may, and not to defend myself or try to get myself into a position where I was going to stay in that group. I don't know if that makes sense.
You know, that makes sense.
But I felt just be quiet, let the division happen. And I don't know to what end, but, you know, even to this day, that particular apostle will, whenever I talk to him, he'll express regret. I wish things were different. I really wish things were different. So
I wish you didn't have black blood, huh? Is that what he's saying?
In essence, you know.
Oh.
But at the same time, I don't really hold odd against him. I don't really, you know, I don't know how else to put it. Things happen the way they were supposed to. And I'm blessed because I've come to a greater understanding through all these things. And, you know, there were things like I used to say, you know, the priesthood ban always bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to say things like, if it wasn't for Pearl of Great Price, I would totally reject it. Except the Pearl of Great Price is pretty clear. You know, it says that
Abraham, you're talking about.
Yeah, where it says you know, Pharaoh being of that lineage that's cursed pertaining to the priesthood, not having the right to the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I started examining things, and does it really say what we think it says? It doesn't say really, if you look at it objectively and look at it, it doesn't really say that they can't hold the priesthood.
There's a guy named Alma Allred that used the scriptures to debunk the ban, and he talks a lot about that verse in Abraham, yeah.
I wonder if he came to the same conclusion I did, which was in essence that it's just speaking a birthright. It's not speaking about whether they can hold the priesthood or not.
I'd have to read that article again. I'll send you an article.
Where it says not having the rights to the priesthood just simply means a birthright. It doesn't mean can't hold the priesthood.
Yeah.
So that's a conclusion I came. And so, you know, since then I've been cut off. What's happened is that I know that this issue is going to come up wherever I go.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with punk rock polygamist Moroni Jessup. Our next conversation will be our last with Moroni, and it's only going to be available to newsletter subscribers. So be sure to subscribe to gospeltangents.com/newsletter, and I'll send you a secret link to the final part of our conversation. We're going to find out a very interesting one drop in the Allred group.
So I met with a woman over in Idaho, and she showed me, and I wish I had a copy. James Allred was the first Allred convert to the church. His wife, Elizabeth Allred, she was a seamstress. She is the first seamstress to make garments for Joseph Smith. She and her husband, James, were sealed in the Red Brick Store.
Okay.
And I saw with my own eyes her census record. Born in the late 1700s, it listed mulatto.
Really?
Yeah.
So all the Allreds have black blood.
apparently.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, subscribe on either Patreon or at gospeltangents.com. For just $5 a month, you can hear the entire audio uninterrupted. On our $10 tier, if you'd like to see the whole video, you can see that either on youtube.com/gospeltangents, or I've got a special Facebook group devoted for full videos. So subscribe at gospeltangents.com and sign up for just $10 a month. For $20 a month, if you'd like to get some bonus content, maybe some of the stuff that ended up on the cutting room floor, you can sign up for that. And then if you'd like to talk to me for $100 a month, we'll do a monthly phone call on something like Zoom, and you can ask me anything you want. So thanks again. Also, don't forget about the merch, mugs, t-shirts, hats, things like that. I'm trying to get the ties up there. Hopefully I can get up there. And thanks again for watching Gospel Tangents. And click here for some more videos.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.